All right, Tuesday night Bible study, The Art of Dying. Let's see, week eight, I think we're on week eight. So we again have a special guest tonight, Tamara Paulin. I'll introduce her again halfway through. She's got some wonderful information for us. But before that, we're going to do the last part of the book that we've been going through, The Art of Dying. So part four that we did last week, if you'll remember, that's very briefly, I'll mention it. It was on page 68 and 69. Temptation of the Devil Concerning Vainglory. And remember, vainglory, vanity, that's all about me, and glory, to glorify. So vainglory, another word for it is pride, that you're glorifying yourself. And this one is particularly effective against Christians, against God's people. Because sometimes we get all wrapped up in saying, well, look at me, I've been a faithful Christian, I've gone to church all my life, I've tithed, of course God is going to save me. And so this is an effective temptation against us, God's faithful people. Of course, is that why we're going to be saved? Because you were faithful all your life and going to church and tithing and volunteering and helping? No, that's not why you're going to be saved. You do all of that, and that's a good thing to do, but that's not why you're going to be saved. Right there is why you're going to be saved, because Jesus died for you. All of us are sinners. So that's what we talked about last week. Any questions from last week? Okay, then the last temptation that we're going to talk about is the temptation of the devil concerning avarice. So this is on page 75, 76, 77, that's where it starts. 76 and 77. So avarice. That is, I would use the word maybe indulgence or
greed.
Yes, you could put greed in that. Yep, that would be part of it too. If you look at that little woodcut, remember this was written back in the Middle Ages. This is an old book. If you look at that woodcut, there's the dying man on his deathbed, and what are the demons doing? They're pointing to everything. Like there's a horse in a stable, and there's a building, a house with stuff in it. He's got barrels in there, probably had wine or beer in it. They're pointing to all the friends around him and the people around him. What's missing? Anything pertaining to God or Jesus is missing. So, again, these are short chapters. I'm going to read a good portion of the chapter for us and talk about it as we go along. So on page 77. The fifth temptation of the devil is avarice, which threatens non-religious and secularly minded people to a greater extent, although it still impacts us Christians. But this is one that is a little more targeted towards maybe weak Christians or non-Christians. Okay, continuing. Avarice is the excessive preoccupation with the passing of this world, wives and worldly friends, material wealth, and other things that they have loved greatly in life. Through these things, the devil especially vexes a person at the point of death, saying, "Oh, wretch, soon you will leave behind all the temporal goods you have amassed with the greatest care and effort. Even your wife, your children, your kindred, your dearest friends, and all other desirable things of this world. Their companionship could be of great solace for you and an occasion of great good for them." The devil places before the person at the point of death these and similar enticements, so that out of love and greed for worldly things, he may turn away from the love of God and his own salvation. So, yes, the devil tempts us to be consumed by the things of this world, even at the point of death, of all times. You know your death is coming, you're on your deathbed, you know, matter of days, weeks, months, whatever. Should we be concerned with the matters of this earthly life? No, not at all. That's part of why we have this class. So you can get all those matters settled years beforehand and be at ease in your mind. My affairs are taken care of. I've done what I need to, made all the plans I need to, expressed my wishes to my family. And now what will you focus on? You'll see this when we get to the next couple of pages. We focus on heaven, the things of heaven. That's what we have waiting for us. And then you'll see there's a footnote there, footnote 56, but kind of right down there. He quotes 1 Timothy 6, 9 to 10. Those who desire to be rich fall into temptation, into a snare, for the love of money is the root of all evils. You've heard that before. It's not money itself that's a root of evil. It's the love of money that's a root of all evil. We are to be generous. We are to be gracious. We are to be charitable with all of our things. So, and of course, when we, you know what I would throw in here too? Because in this, this first paragraph here, he talks about friends and family and your wife and children. I think one of the other things in here that consumes some people is fame or notoriety. They're consumed with that, especially at the point of death. How will I be known? How will I, my name be preserved for all history? Well, you know what? You'll be in heaven. Who cares? Yeah, right? It doesn't matter. You know, your immediate family, kids, grandkids, they'll remember you. Beyond that, you'll be in heaven with all the saints. What does it matter? All right, let me continue on a little bit. For this reason, it must especially be noted that one should take the greatest care not to recall to the dying person's memory his friends, wife, children, riches, and other things of this passing life, except as his spiritual health demands or requires. I'm not sure I fully agree with that. I think it's okay to reflect and remember your family and friends, especially if they're Christian and they can give you some comfort. They can, you know, talk to you about faith, talk to you about God. I think to some extent that is okay for a dying person to remember those things. Of course, I would agree this much with that. That's not what's foremost on your mind. On the occasions where I have visited somebody and it's known they're going to die soon, you know, matter, you know, they're on hospice or the healthcare says there's nothing more we can do, the medical profession, nothing more we can do. Sometimes hospice makes an estimate of, by the way, we're going to have hospice next week, talking to us about hospice, what it is and what they do, okay? Thanks to Karen. Thank you, Karen, for setting that up, that connection. When I visit them, I'm talking about Jesus. Well, I do that anyway, all the time. I'm talking about Jesus and heaven and what's waiting for them and the glory that is to come. And I point them to that salvation that Jesus has earned for all of us. Guess what? I do that all the time in everything. You know what I heard a pastor once say? Another pastor? I'm stealing somebody else's, yes. Plagiarism, but I don't remember his name. The whole job of the church is to prepare you for heaven. To prepare you to die and go to heaven. That's the whole point. Why are you baptized? Very early in your life, for most of us, when you're an infant, you're baptized. Why? So that when you die, you go to heaven. The whole purpose of the church is to prepare you for that. That's incredible, isn't it? All right, turn the page. Let's see. A little bit more on that next page, which is 78. It would be most dangerous, for it would call him back toward those fleeting and worldly anxieties at a time when all his physical and mental faculties must especially focus on things of the Spirit and of salvation. All worldly concerns should be removed from memory and from the mind with the greatest care, since clearly at that time a preoccupation with them is most dangerous. So see, I do sort of agree with that. If somebody, you know, well, I want to say goodbye to, you know, my nephew or, you know, grandkids who I haven't seen in a while or whatever. Yes, to a certain extent, we can bring those things up to a person who's dying and they can say their last wishes or just, you know, greet them or, you know, if there's something bothering them, they're on their conscience, ask for forgiveness or offer forgiveness. You know, that's all fine. But they shouldn't be concerned with worldly concerns. I have visited somebody on their deathbed who said, well, Pastor, I'm worried about my kids getting through school, my grandkids, getting through school, through Christ Lutheran. And I said, we'll take care of them. Their scholarship money, they'll be taken care of, they'll get through school. And I will work with the parents who were not very well churched. That's why this concern came up from the grandparent. And I said, I will work with them. Don't you worry about it. Well, Pastor, I want to make sure that, actually this one came up too. I want to make sure that the church gets a gift from my estate. Don't worry about that. We've got plenty of people in the congregation that can help with that. That's part of what this class is. We'll take care of that. Don't worry about it. Well, Pastor, who's going to take care of my family? We've got lots of people in the church. We look out for each other. You know, so I'm putting those things aside. They're concerned with it. And then I refocus them on Jesus. Jesus died for you. And, you know, I'm not going to skirt around the edge. God's going to call you home at some point here in the near future. I don't know when. And I'm a little vague about it. You know, it could be weeks, could be months. Just remember the love Jesus has for you. So I'm trying to brush aside these earthly concerns, these anxieties that they may have, and refocus them on Jesus. That's what we need to do. Focus on heaven, not earthly temporal things. Yes, Stephen.
Okay, so Jesus on the cross, though, took care of some earthly business when he
yes.
looked after his mother. You know, behold your son, behold your mother. So, I don't know, that seems kind of...
No, that dovetails with what I'm saying. If somebody's concerned about something, they can get it off their mind and transfer that concern to someone else.
Okay.
Jesus was concerned about his mother. Joseph obviously had already died. His mother, he wanted to make sure she was cared for. So he transferred that concern to the Apostle John, the disciple whom he loved. We just finished the gospel. So then that concern was taken care of, and then he could focus on finishing the suffering that he was going through for our benefit. So that's why I would say, if somebody has those concerns, yes, we give them assurance that we'll take care of that. We who are left, we'll take care of that. We'll do what they want. Give us your concerns, tell us your thoughts or wishes, we'll take care of that, and then you be at peace and focus on Jesus and what he did for you. So yes, that's a great example, Steve. I think that actually dovetails with what I'm trying to say. Yeah, get it off your mind and be done with it. Push it aside. All right. I think there's also another problem with this whole focus on earthly things. If somebody knows they're going to be dying soon, and say it's not a disease that immobilizes them, but they still have mobility and access and can get around, they might be tempted to indulge in earthly sins. Well, I'm going to die soon. I might as well go about philandering about or drinking to get drunk or engaging in all these sinful activities because I'm going to die anyway. See, that's a temptation for a non-believer because they have either a marginal understanding of salvation and heaven or a non-understanding of heaven. So if they're not going to be saved anyway, I might as well hardy hardy now because I'm about to die soon. That's the wrong attitude too, right? All right, look at 58, the footnote there, 58. The best support that family and friends can offer at this challenging time is solidarity in prayer and other religious practices, all of which direct attention to things of the Spirit and of salvation. I wholeheartedly agree with that comment by this anonymous author here. We don't know who wrote this. I've told them. Nobody knows who wrote this. Some medieval age monk. This was written before the time of Luther. So I do agree. The best thing you can do is just to be with someone. Pray for them. Encourage them. Sing hymns. Talk to them about Bible stories. Read Psalms. Just being with them to comfort and encourage. Okay, then... good inspiration of the angel concerning avarice. So you turn the page over, pages 80 and 81. And there you see another woodcut. A lot of illiteracy back then. There's the dying man on his bed, and what is the angel pointing to right in front of him? Pointing to Christ on the cross. Perfect. Exactly. Whoever wrote this got it exactly right. And where is that demon? The demon is kind of cowering down in the bottom corner there. So, yes, that's what we do, is we point to Christ. So let me again read a little bit on this. Against the fifth temptation of the devil, the angel gives good inspiration, saying, O man, turn your ears away from the deadly suggestions of the devil, which he uses to try to provoke and poison you, and place totally behind you all the things of this world, since remembering them surely brings nothing of salvation, but greatly impedes it. Be mindful of the Lord's words to those who cling to these things. Whoever does not renounce all things, whatever he possesses, cannot be my disciple. Jesus said that. And again, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. Jesus said that. In turn, to those who renounce these things, he says, and everyone who has left behind house or brothers or sisters or father or mother or wife or children or lands on account of my name will receive 100-fold and possess eternal life. Now, just a brief comment in here. Jesus does say, if you don't hate your family, you cannot be saved. That's a little bit confusing to us in English. I've said this before in other Bible studies, and I know. So I looked up my notes just to verify. And I actually looked up in my Greek dictionary. The word for hate there in Greek is meseo. And actually, the first definition of that in Greek is to wish ill of someone. Hate. However, the second definition of that word meseo in Greek is to love something less than something else. That's what Jesus is referring to. You should love your family less than you love him. You still love them, but they're second place. What's first? Jesus and God. And your family is second. And what's way down there on the list? Yourself. That's the problem. We usually want to put ourselves up at number one. Above Jesus, above family, and above everything else. Well, we are down there at fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh place. Somewhere down there. Okay. Alright, let me read on a little bit more. Remember also the poverty of Christ hanging on the cross for you, who willingly left behind his most beloved mother and dearest disciples for your salvation. Consider also that so many holy men followed him in that same contempt for worldly things in order to hear the words, come, blessed of my Father, possess the kingdom prepared for you from the beginning of the world. So there's a little allusion there, Steve, to what you mentioned about Jesus and his mother. He took care of her, but then he transferred that concern to someone else and then went on with the business, well, frankly, of dying. Alright, skip down to the last paragraph there. Note that when the sick person perceives he is being tempted by avarice or love of earthly things, he should first consider that this worldly love separates him from God because it excludes the love of God. Number one, first commandment, you shall have no other gods before me. God is number one. Jesus is number one. So any love that we place higher than God then overshadows or excludes the love of God. There's the problem. I want to add something here, kind of Lutheranize this a little bit. So another passage you can reference here. Let me see how quickly I can call it up on the screen. So let's see, Bible Gateway, English, okay. 1 Peter, this is what I'm going to look up. 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 6 to 7. 1 Peter chapter 1, 6 to 7. This is what Peter says. In this you rejoice, though now for a little while, if necessary, you have been grieved by various trials, so that the tested genuineness of your faith, more precious than gold that perishes though it is tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. What is the most precious thing you own? It's not your house. It's not your car. It's not your boat. It's not your pension fund. It's not your retirement account. The most precious thing you own is your faith. More precious than gold. Right there. I think that helps us remember when we are tempted, whether we're approaching death or not, when we are tempted by earthly things. Remember, those are not what matters. Your faith is what matters. Okay? Questions? Comments? All right. Then the conclusion, because we're going to finish this, and then next week we're going to talk about hospice and Christian care at life's end. So we're going to get into those booklets that I got over there on the counter. We'll get into those next week. But go to page 85. So the kind of the conclusion of this booklet. If the suffering person can speak and use his mental faculties, let him pour forth prayers to God. First, he should beg the Lord that through his ineffable mercy and the power of his passion, he may deign to receive him. Yes, Martin Luther said, on his deathbed, Anybody remember the famous last words of Martin Luther right before he died? He said, "It is true, we are all beggars." That's what he said. What do we do before God? We don't earn our way. We don't buy our way. We beg God. Lord, have mercy. Kyrie. You've all heard me say it multiple times. I think it's the second best prayer. You're just begging God, like blind beggar, like blind Bartimaeus, the beggar. We're just saying, God, have mercy on me. That's it. So, what should somebody do as they approach the end of life? As long as you have your mental faculties, pray. Now, the rest of this paragraph on page 85 you can ignore, because he talks about praying the rosary. So, we all know that the Blessed Virgin Mary, while she is a saint, and we should honor her, she's not God, so we don't pray to Mary. And I know not all Catholics believe that anyway, so that's kind of a controversial thing a little bit, even within the Catholic Church. So the rest of that part you can ignore. Turn the page. So page 86, this is the end of the book. So the second line down. Finally, he should say, "Into your hands I commend my spirit." Oh, who said that? Jesus. And what was Jesus actually doing when he prayed that from the cross? He was quoting Psalm 31. He was quoting a psalm. But if the sick person does not know the prayers to say, yeah, that might be, someone attending to him should say prayers aloud in his presence, or read to him devout stories he enjoyed when he was well. But let him pray in his heart and with longing as he knows he is able. Yes, yes, yes. Ignoring the part where this guy talks about the rosary, ignoring that part, the rest of this is true. When you're in your last days and your last hours, keep this in mind. This will be true for me too when I'm in my last days and last hours. Just pray. Sing hymns. Hymns are prayers. Read the Psalms. Psalms are prayers. Pray the Lord's Prayer. Recite the Apostles' Creed. Have somebody read to you stories from the Bible. That's wonderful. That's what you do. Okay? And that keeps your mind focused on heaven that is to come, and it wipes out these temptations that this author talks about, which are true. These are valid temptations. So, my last little bit on here is I'm going to give you some examples. You can write some little notes there. There's some space there. I would say you can pray the Lord's Prayer and the Kyrie. You can recite the creeds. Apostles' Creed is best because it's shorter and it's the one that we learn first as children. I would also say read and or recite or pray Psalm 27, Psalm 31, Psalm 23. Lots of people know that one by heart. And Psalm 121. Those are awesome psalms, those four psalms, and they all point you to heaven. Okay? So those are some psalms that you can pray and or read. And if you know any hymns, one that I have sung to my kids, Jill and I have sung to our kids from the time they were little, and they know it by heart now. It's 610 in the hymnal. It's, "Lord Jesus, think on me. Lord Jesus, think on me." And it's a prayer. I usually end it with amen. Remember when our hymnal used to have amen at the end of all the hymns? The old red hymnal? We don't anymore. I've asked Mark about that, and he gives me some reason, and I'm like, whatever. So, yeah, hymns. That's what you do. Okay? So that's advice. All right. Questions, comments?
No, Pastor.
Yes.
Quick one. Between Sandy and I, when we talk about the person who gets rid of all their work, does not live a good life.
Yeah.
And all they're going to die. We had a brother-in-law do that. The long-range thing, what, 13 years he's been gone?
16.
16. Is that he has a widow now who's ill, no financial means to be taken care of. And
because he knew he was only going to live for a few more years, and so he took out all of his, you know, like 401k or whatever, and, you know.
Cash and just blew it on stuff?
Oh, yeah.
By the way, if there is somebody who's not lived the cleanest of life or the most godly of life, but now facing death, they've come to the reality, they've come to their senses, you know, prodigal son, a good thing to do for them is this. Remember, I talked about this already, commendation of the dying. What's it include at the beginning? The assurance of forgiveness. Even better, call a pastor. I would come and visit, and I would give them actual absolution. In the stead and by the command of our Lord Jesus Christ, I forgive you. Of course, you can do this, and you say, and it's the reminder that Jesus died, so you are forgiven. Also, within this are a whole bunch of good prayers. There's a litany for the dying in here. So add on to the notes I told you, those other psalms. You could read the prayers in here. These are good prayers, too. Okay? All right. Thank you for your comments. All right, anything else? All right, we got half an hour at least. You can run over 5 or 10 minutes if you need to, Tamara. So let me introduce, most of you I think already know Tamara Paulin. She's a trust attorney. And so when Church Extension Fund here was here, Julie Burgess, she talked about, was emphasizing the necessity of having a plan so that things are in place. Because otherwise, you have this ugly head rearing over you called probate court, which sucks time and money from your estate and from your heirs. We want to avoid that. That's a good thing. Now, one of the things, I don't know if you were aware of this, but Julie said that as a feature of the foundation from the Church Extension Fund, she's one of the consultants or whatever, you can make an appointment, and they will come out, and she'll explain everything to you, teach you about it, give you some advice. They have some boilerplate that you can use, and help you gather your documents so that when you do go see an attorney, she said, then you have less billable hours and you understand what you're talking about. So that's part of that, and they offer that free of charge. And Church Extension Fund holds our church mortgage, so that's a benefit all of us can take advantage of. I intend to do that, Jill and I too. I'm going to call Julie and say sometime over the summer, can you come out and meet with us? Tamara's going to explain to us a little more of the nitty-gritty details, okay, about trusts and powers of attorney and living wills and all of that, all right? So buckle your seatbelts and get ready and have questions ready. All right, Tamara, thank you for being here.
Sure thing.
Oh, let me put your stuff back on the screen.
Start with saying it's a little tough to follow because a lot of what I'm going to talk about does, in fact, focus on things of this world. But I will say that I have witnessed firsthand many, many times the sheer relief that people do experience once they get their affairs in order so that they can focus on what's really important at the end. So while this does deal with stuff and things and everything you're going to leave behind, including your family, it really does provide just a huge relief. You can almost see it off coming off people's shoulders as they leave after they've signed everything. So,
All I have to do is click the mouse or hit the enter key or the space bar and it'll advance.
There we go.
There you go.
Okay, so Tamara Paulin, also known as the school board lady.
Yeah.
Got two kids here in school, Hadley and Amelia. They're in second and fifth grades respectively. Married to John, who's about to become the properties board guy. So we're about to get really busy here after the summer. As Pastor mentioned, outside of that, I am an estate planning attorney by trade. Went to Hillsdale College, which is where John and I met. He came back with me to the Chicago area, which is where I am from. I went to John Marshall Law School. Spent about 10 years in private practice in the Chicago area, focusing mostly on estate planning and probate administration. I was recruited here about 7 years ago by First Source Bank to run their St. Joseph Trust Office. And about 2 years ago, I was recruited away from there to work with the South Bend team at Key Bank. So what I do now is I'm a trust officer, or in fancy legal jargon, a fiduciary strategist. So I'm on the other side of the coin. So instead of drafting documents for people, I'm actually the one that's administering them. So serving as the trustee or the personal representative, handling all the administration after someone passes away, working with beneficiaries and loved ones to get things distributed properly and settled.
What bank are you with now?
Key Bank.
Oh, Key Bank, okay.
Yep. We do not have any local offices. So I get to drive the South Bend a lot. Unfortunately, I can tell you, in addition to the technical professional experience, I also have a lot of personal experience, dealing with death, dying, and taking care of things after loved ones have passed away. Lost both my parents in 2020, followed by my grandma, and my younger sister passed away in 22. So I can talk to it, at it, from both the very technical side as well as the practical side of how this actually really truly matters. and why it's so important to get done for your family. So I will skip through a lot of this, because Julie probably covered it, but in its simplest sense, an estate plan is a collection of documents outlining your wishes should you die or become incapacitated. I will highlight the incapacitated part, because that often gets overlooked and forgotten. As we are living longer, incapacity and mental decline is increasing. So if all you have is a will, you're not covered. So that's why the complete kind of plan is important and not just a will. Also, if you have any questions at any time, please just stop me. It'll be a lot more exciting if you're asking questions and not just talking. So let's see. Again, I think Julie touched on a lot of this, so I'm just going to add that they are really important reasons. They really do matter, so don't gloss over those and don't take for granted.
And I think probably a lot of people, that point number five, relieves stress and reduces conflict. I have heard from many of you that you have a family member or a parent pass away and they don't have an adequate will or maybe nothing at all, and you've got a lot of paperwork and headache and legal stuff to go through, versus I've heard from other members where everything's all in order and, you know, you can grieve and go through the funeral and everything's kind of, you know, in a matter of weeks or a couple of months, everything's kind of settled. So it makes a big difference.
It does. It makes a vast difference both in terms of speed and cost, but also just being able to have your family kind of preserve relationships and not deal with each other with stressful topics when they're already emotionally exhausted.
Have you had to do that as a trust administrator where you've got family of heirs that are not agreeable with each other or in conflict with each other?
Yes.
And so you have to go by the letter of the estate plan.
Yes, and that is why my job exists, because it makes it a lot easier, especially in situations where there's anticipated conflict. You can name a court, but I am a corporate fiduciary, so you've got this neutral third party that is able to kind of take the heat a little bit, follow what you put in your documents, diffuse the situation, and the hope is to preserve family harmony, because instead of, you know, brothers and sisters going at each other, they can be mad at me, right? And so they can still stay friends.
That doesn't feel good for you, though, does it?
It's very rewarding.
Yeah.
It is, because I've seen it go the other way.
Okay.
So... So during incapacity, this was a thing I did want to touch on. Did Julie talk about
this? No, she didn't.
Okay. So very important, not just when you pass away, but if you were to become incapacitated. So that's dementia, you know, Alzheimer's, you're in a coma. You need to have someone that's legally able to make decisions for you, both financial and related to your finances. So if you don't have your ducks in a row, there would be a legal proceeding required to establish a guardianship. So there is a guardianship of the person, which is of your finances. I'm sorry, a person would be your medical, and then your finances would be of your estate, your finances, your checking accounts, paying your bills, that kind of thing. In order to be established as a guardian, you would need that whoever's seeking the guardianship, so you want to be appointed guardian for mom or your sister, you would have to go to court, file the appropriate paperwork, and have a judge appoint you as the guardian. That can very easily be avoided. So it's important to note that it can be avoided.
So you avoid that by having your estate plan define who that is?
Correct. And that's done in powers of attorney.
So guardianship, I often think about... It's fine.
Yeah.
Guardianship, I think about as for, like, with young kids. Like, my wife and I just did a fill-out-the-blank downloaded from the internet that if she and I both die in a car accident, who will take care of our kids? And we designated this sister and that brother and whatever. You're talking about, that's talking about if I have dementia and can't take care of myself.
Correct. There are, it's the same legal process,
mm-hmm.
but one is for a minor because they also do not have legal capacity
mm-hmm.
to make decisions for themselves, to own property,
mm-hmm.
same as an incapacitated adult.
Sure.
So yes, but the guardianship for children is actually taken care of under your will. So it's
okay.
in a different document, but still part of the estate plan. So talk about probate, so I'm not going to focus on that because I think Julie covered that. It is not the end of the world, but it's really nice if you can avoid it. So I know some attorneys and people use it as a scare tactic. things are going to be fine if you have to go through probate, but it is easier for your family if you don't have to.
And you know, she said the exact same thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Page up on that. There you go.
Okay. Yeah, so that deals with the statute. If you own minimal assets, you can avoid probate by filling out what's called a small estate affidavit, and whoever's going to settle your affairs, if you don't own individually titled real estate or assets totaling more than $28,000, they can transfer, like say you have a couple thousand dollars in your checking account, they would be able to fill out that small estate affidavit and get access to that account after your death without going through probate. But that's a pretty low threshold.
Yeah.
It's one of the lower ones I've seen. So, did Julie go into probate versus non-probate assets?
A little bit.
Okay.
Like, what did she talk about? I mean, most of you were here. There was something, real estate needs to go through probate unless in Michigan you have a ladybird deed.
Or it's jointly titled.
It's jointly titled.
Yep.
But other things you can have beneficiaries on, like life insurance, checking accounts, etc.
Right.
So she touched on it a little bit.
Okay. Yep. So basically, probate assets are those that would funnel through your estate. Non-probate assets are those that transfer outside of your estate. So you want to effectively or efficiently, you want to die with no probate assets. Save money. Okay. So on to the documents. We've kind of got two categories, pre-death and post-death. This is a pre-death document. The financial power of attorney will allow you to name an individual who will step in the event that you become incapacitated. That person will have access to all of your financial accounts. They will be able to write checks on your behalf. They'll be able to contact your 401k provider and get information. All those things while you are not able to. It's a creature of statute, so it's created by statute. You have to meet the statutory requirements, which you have to have two non-named witnesses sign as witnesses. So you can't name Joe Smith as your agent and then have Joe Smith as a witness. Yes?
So does this have to be enacted by an attorney?
It does not.
So you can do this on your own without an attorney.
You can.
But you don't advise it. It's not suggested.
In some cases, it could be fine.
Okay.
And actually, the power of attorney is actually, there is a sample or a draft in the statute that you can use. The problem is, generally, individuals will need more than just a power of attorney. So, and the attorney can also tweak it and adjust it to provide for, you know, carve outs or things that you want specifically. There are two types of financial powers of attorney called durable or springing. Durable means it is effective immediately upon your signing. So if you name your sister, she can act on your behalf from that day forward.
Even if you're not yet capacitated?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. So be careful who you name. Be careful the type of document you get. Springing power of attorney is effective only upon the onset of incapacity. So the document would spell out what incapacity is, how you prove that, whether you need a doctor's note, whether you need three doctor's notes, whether you need consensus among your children. It can be anything that you lay out. Under the springing, then once that incapacity is established, the agent that you named then can start acting. Yes?
I'm going to guess most married couples would name each other, but then would you need another person in case your spouse is already deceased before you or you're both incapacitated at the same time? Then you would have probably a child, one of the kids or something?
Yep. And so I would actually recommend taking it a step further.
Okay.
I usually recommend that they've got their spouse and then two backups. I like having a deep bench because you just never know what's going to happen. Deaths can happen in short succession, so that takes out your first agent. And then what if the second agent is out of the country or simply unwilling? And if your document doesn't have that third person, you could be out of luck, and then you would be back in the guardianship.
So you mentioned unwilling. Shouldn't they be asked before you do this document?
That's at the end of the presentation.
Okay.
But yes, yes, you would not believe how many times people are named in documents and have no idea.
All right.
I'd like to ask questions.
I'm asking questions.
No, that's good. Don't do that. And obviously, since this is a pre-dot document, it ends at the person's passing. So that is when the death documents kind of take over, and what you set out in those documents come into play. I will say, just a practical tip, when you get your financial power of attorney done, some banks can be real sticklers about whether or not they will accept them from your agent. That's the person you name. Save the headache. Once you get it drafted, take it to your bank, your financial institution, have them review it, have them have their legal department review it, make sure it's okay, and then have them put that with your account on your file. So that when something happens and that agent needs to go into the bank to write checks to pay your electricity bill or whatever, they're not going to have a bank that comes back and says, oh no, this is 5 years old, we can't take it if it's more than 2 years old. Or no, it doesn't have this provision, we can't take it. So I've seen it happen, it's just a hassle. So that's a way to avoid that.
And you work for a bank.
A couple of them, yes. There are people above me, though. the healthcare power of attorney is a similar document, except it deals with healthcare decisions. It's also a creation of statute, meaning the statutory provisions have to be followed. Also requires two non-named witnesses. Again, you're the principal. You're naming agents who can make medical and healthcare decisions for you. It avoids that guardianship of the person in court before you would pass away. Also terminates at the principal's death. And as a result, you should include for the disposition of remains in the document so that they don't run into that issue. An attorney would obviously put that in there for you.
Would that include if somebody wants to donate their body to medical science or something?
Absolutely. Yep.
Now, do most people have the same person for financial and healthcare power of attorney?
Great question. A lot of them do because they don't know they don't have to.
Oh.
So you absolutely can name different people. A lot of times the family's going to have someone that's really great in finance, but couldn't care less, is not very sensitive, doesn't understand medical stuff. You don't have to name them. Name the nurse in your family to be your healthcare power of attorney. Name the accountant to be your financial power of attorney. You can absolutely do that. And another practical tip, like you mentioned, give it to whoever's named. Talk to them about it. Give them a copy so that when they need it, they're not scrounging around your house trying to find where you stashed that all-important binder. Obviously, also talk to them about it beforehand. The document is drafted by statute, so it's kind of generic. Take it a step further. Actually sit down with at least the first or second person that you've got named in there. Tell them what your wishes are. Talk to them about how you want to receive medical care at the end. It will make a huge difference to them knowing that they are just following your wishes as opposed to having to make these decisions on their own. So that is like the greatest gift that you can give whoever you give this very, very hard job to. Talk to them, tell them what you want, so they are just doing what you told them. That will make it easier for them. Okay. Last pre-death document, a living will, declaration, advance directive. This addresses what extraordinary measures you may or may not want at the end of life. Goes hand in hand with the healthcare power of attorney. Share this with your healthcare providers as well as your healthcare power of attorney, and again, talk to them about it. All right, we are now on to, well, this one's fun because it actually is pre- and post-death. The revocable trust, the living trust, also known as the grantor trust. They are all the same thing. What it is it's kind of your alter ego while you're alive. It's a set of instructions that you draft telling your successor trustees how you want your affairs handled at your death. While you're alive, generally you're going to be the trustee. You're in charge. It's really things function just as they always had been, except your bank statements are now going to come in the name of your revocable living trust. I explain it a lot as like an envelope. You have all of your assets, your bank accounts, your car, your house, and it's all inside this envelope. Right now, my envelope says Tamara Pollan. because that's how I own all my assets. I don't really, but once you draft your trust and you fund it, the title on that document changes, or on that envelope changes to Tamara Paulin Living Trust. And I put a set of instructions in that envelope, which is my trust document. And it tells that trustee what to do with all the things inside that envelope. But the cool thing is, when I pass away or become incapacitated, that successor trustee takes that envelope and runs with it. Does not have to go to probate, does not have to go through the court, picks it up, takes the instructions out of the document, and does what I have written down in there. So during life, you're holding that envelope. You can take those instructions out, you can tweak them, you can completely tear them up and start over, but it is there when... You know, when you become incapacitated or pass away, it does become irrevocable. You can't change it. It uses your same social security number. So like I said, it really is just your alter ego while you're alive. The way that those assets that are in that envelope or in that trust are able to avoid probate is that at your death, a new tax ID number is assigned to that now irrevocable trust. So it continues on as a separate entity, even though you as an entity have ceased. Any questions?
So revocable means you can change it while you're alive as often as you want or whatever you want. When you die, it becomes irrevocable to whoever becomes your next trustee, your spouse, your child, whoever.
Correct.
And they have to follow then the instructions that are in there.
Correct.
That's a great illustration of the envelope. Thank you. That's a good way to explain it. That helps me.
And then obviously within that trust document, then you not only name your successor trustee, who is the person or persons who are going to take that envelope and do the things listed on the trust document, it also tells that person what to do with your assets. There are myriad ways that that can go. It could be as simple as give everything outright to my daughter. Simple. It could be give $10,000 to my daughter at my passing. Give a third of the trust then when she turns 45, another third at 55, the final third at 65. But before she reaches 65, you can give principal and income distributions for health, education, maintenance, and support. You can specify if you want things to go for a down payment of a house, or if you want to allow funds to be invested to start up a business. It really is a very, very flexible document.
You can give a tithe to your church.
You can also give it to your church. I would recommend using your IRA though, instead, for tax reasons. So, and that would be all the stuff that you would sit down with the attorney to talk about, but it's always really good to have an idea of what you might want, but just don't be constrained in what you think you can put in there, because it's a very flexible document, and, you know, if you've got one daughter or one child that's really financially responsible and one that is very much not, you can create separate shares and treat them each according to their needs. So,
If I heard you right, you said the living trust will avoid probate?
Correct. If you fund it, if you put the assets into that envelope.
And something about on passing, a new tax ID is created?
Correct.
By whom?
The trustee, the successor trustee. They would apply to the IRS to obtain that.
So is that a way also to help avoid some taxes, inheritance tax or whatever?
No.
No. Okay.
Not inheritance tax, because this is, in order to get it, to avoid inheritance or estate or death tax, you have to get the asset out of your estate. In order to do that, you have to give up control. As I mentioned at the beginning, you're keeping all the control. So what you would use in that situation would probably be an irrevocable trust. So if you had excess funds and you were going to exceed the $12.6 million lifetime exemption that's currently in effect, and you could carve out $3 million, put it in irrevocable trust for your daughter or whatever. I keep saying daughter, maybe your son. I obviously have girls. And it would get that $3 million out of your estate, and then the rest could pass under the irrevocable trust.
So is that the cap right now, $12 million?
12.61.
But so if we're under that in total assets, we don't have to worry about the death tax? I don't think any of us would have to worry about that.
If you die before 12/31/2025, because the current legislation is set to sunset, and it will revert back to...
The government is awful.
It will revert back to $5 million adjusted for inflation. So because we don't know this year's inflation and next year's inflation, we can't give an exact number, but it should be between $6 and $7 million per person.
But if we're under that number,
correct,
then we don't have to. So yes, whatever the number is that given year, if you're under that, you don't have to pay the debt tax.
Correct.
Well, I know I'm under $5 million, so I'm still paying.
Yes. And that's for each individual too. So a married couple gets double that. So that excludes even after the sunset, a vast majority of people. Yeah. So. Any more questions on the trust? Yes.
I've read that one of the documents that you should have with your trust is a for your successor trustee.
Mm-hmm.
Is something with your passwords, your email and your passwords for all your financial accounts, because in this day and age you're going to be doing electronic stuff and it makes life easier.
Yes. There is the technically correct answer, the legal answer, and then there's the practical answer. The legal answer is they should not be accessing your account using your credentials because that is technically a violation of the terms and conditions. Practical answer is yes, do that. Because otherwise they're going to have one heck of a time trying to get into those accounts, and talking to a representative at an 800 number is going to make them lose their mind. So yes. Problem with that is you got to keep updating it every time you get that. Reset your password reminder, you got to go into the page. They do have online password keepers now. Steve, you can probably talk to them more than I even could. But they have online password keepers that actually track all of your online passwords and update them automatically. So that's kind of how the IT world is catching up to the paper cross-off list. But yes, I do recommend to have a binder. Put it somewhere that, you know, people know where it is. Put not only all these documents in there, put a copy of each statement in there so they know who your financial rep is and who to call so they're not calling the 800 number for Chase and get someone, you know, overseas before they settle on your person over in Stevensville, right? That just saves them a ton of effort. Put in there the names of your doctors, contact information for your doctors, contact information for your attorney and your CPA. And that will make it a lot easier. All right. Anything else? Okay. The last document or post-death document that I will talk about is the will. Depending on whether you're doing a trust plan or a non-trust plan, the will function differently. So if you have a revocable or a living trust in your estate plan, the will is going to be what's called a pour-over will. So it's really just going to act as a funnel for any assets you forgot to put into that envelope. And it's going to take those assets and funnel them into your trust so that those provisions you carefully wrote out will govern all of your assets. Again, it's governed by statute. Those are the requirements. When you die, it has to be filed. It's easier. The process is simpler. If there is no probate, you don't have to prove it up or do anything like that. And to your point earlier, this is where you appoint guardians for minor children. So the will is still important, even if you have a trust. If you do not have a trust, it's even more important because it will provide all the dispositive provisions, but it will go, most likely it will require your estate to go through probate. Yes?
If you have property, but if you don't have property, the will is sufficient.
If you don't have assets exceeding $28,000 in your individual name or real estate that's individually titled, yes. Very case specific, so sorry to give the attorney answers, but let's see. So yeah, will's pretty much what it is. Any questions? Yeah.
Yeah. What written instructions should we leave for our designated trustee or whoever's going to take care of our stuff?
Mm-hmm.
They're gonna be overwhelmed real quick. What written instructions can we give to them or have ready for them? We'll say, okay, you need to do A, B, C, D, you know, to get started, to, you know, who to contact and that sort of thing.
Right, and that's why who you name is so important, and I point on that later, is you want to have someone that can handle it, right? It's not an honor. It's a job. It's often a very thankless and unpaid job. So think about who you're going to name, and that's where I would put in the name of your attorney. I would put your CPA in there. They are going to become very tight with that individual you've identified for, you know, a few months following the death.
You mentioned it's a thankless job, and I've heard that. Can you designate a fee or a salary for the person you name as trust?
Yes.
So, you know, you got my kids, and I name one of them as the trustee and say, they're getting an extra 10% of the estate for doing this. And it may cheese off the other kids, but they're doing a lot of work.
Yes. Yes, you can. I would recommend that you set a fixed amount in there for that very reason.
Oh, yeah.
Because if you are going to name one child, that child already is going to have a target on their back because they were chosen. They have access to everything. The other kids have access literally to nothing unless that child shares it. And then if they're taking money out, it's a bad look, right? But if you have spelled out in there, they're going to get paid $15 an hour for their work, and they keep track of their hours, which they are required by law to do. It's going to be a lot easier because they can say, look, this is what mom and dad put in there. It's a lot of work. This is all the time I put in. So if you are going to do that, I would specify exactly what you want them to get paid and talk to your kids about it. Say, I'm naming so-and-so because I think they're going to do the best job, or, you know, I think they're oldest, they have the most financial savvy, whatever the reason is, and I do want them to get paid for it because it is a lot of work. They already have a job, you know, whatever. If all the kids know, or if all the family or loved ones know in advance, it takes a lot of the sting out.
Yeah.
So. Okay, who needs an estate plan? Everyone over 18 should at least think about an estate plan. Because as I mentioned, once you are no longer a minor, you are your own individual person. Your parents can't get information. They can't get access to your bank account. They can't provide healthcare instructions to your doctors because they are their own legal, you know, entity. So I often encourage clients that I'm working with, while you're going in to get your estate plan done, get one done for your kid that's going off to college in the fall. All they will probably need is a healthcare and a financial power of attorney, but at least that allows you to be able to get access to their records, their things, if something catastrophic were to happen. And we kind of touched on some of the simple planning techniques, but the thing to focus on is they still require planning. So it's not just going to all fall into place without doing some work. and then the other... So we touched on this, fund your trust. But when I say fund your trust, put the assets in that trust envelope if you have a trust. That means go to your bank. Your bank account needs to be retitled in the name of your trust. Your house deed needs to be put in the name of your trust. Your investment accounts need to be put in the name of your trust. So you would need to work with each of those advisors to have it retitled. They're going to be familiar with this. This is not going to be new. It's going to require some paperwork, and it's a pain, but they know how to do it. You just have to tell them, this is the name of the trust. I want it retitled in the name of the trust, and that's putting those assets into the envelope so the envelope passes to the successor without going to court. A lot of attorneys do not do that step. So they will send you off with this binder. It's very nice, very thick, very expensive binder with lots of pages in it. But they don't talk to you about how important it is, or they don't work with you to put the assets into your trust. Well, you've just paid a really lot of money for some paper, because it doesn't actually do what you set out to do unless it's funded. So make sure to do that. Mentioned earlier, share your documents with the people that you've named in there so that they are not caught off guard, so that you know that they are willing to do that, and you can have those conversations with them in advance. Revisit your estate plan. Doesn't probably have to be a yearly thing, but the laws do change, personal situations change. So I recommend every 5 to 10 years at a minimum, or if there is a change in circumstances, if there's a death, a divorce, birth, any of those things could trigger changes to your plan, so I would revisit the plan when one of those things happen. It could be as simple as a phone call to your attorney. hey, my son just had a baby. Do I need to do anything different in my estate plan? It really should be that simple. He or she should be able to tell you yes or no. And then choose your successors, your agents, wisely. Are they trustworthy? We talked about the durable spring or the durable power of attorney. You're giving that person access to your assets right now. Make sure you trust them. And I often tell people, if you don't trust them enough to be in control of your assets right now, why would you trust them under a springing power of attorney to use them how you want them to when you're incapacitated? So really think about who you're naming and make sure you trust that person. Make sure they're competent. There are a lot of tax and legal issues that are going to have to be handled. So make sure that the person that you are naming is up to the task. And then lastly, and most practically speaking, do they have the time? You know, a lot of individuals will name their kids. Well, their kids have three kids under the age of five. They both, you know, both spouses work full time. They simply don't have the time to deal with something like this. So really think of the practical impact of naming that person. Are they local? If you live here and your only child's in California, does he or she have time to come back to hold an estate sale, clean out your house, sell your house? Maybe, maybe not. So just think about the practical implications as well. There are also, obviously, corporate fiduciaries who that's all we do. So, the slides in the back.
Question.
Oh.
Cameron?
Yes?
So if a husband and a wife each have a trust, you kind of want to balance, you know, the funding of those. As long as both are living, assets could be moved one trust to the other and such. You know, you sold this house or property, so now maybe you want to balance differently. Is that doable?
It is, because there's an unlimited marital gifting. So you can give back and forth as much as you want. A lot of older estate plans, though, that have two trusts were written when the exemption was even lower than the $6 to $7 million we're going back to. So a lot of times you could even simplify down to one trust if you're already looking at them again.
Nowadays, do most couples just do one trust for the couple?
Depending on their asset level, but yes.
Yeah.
The vast majority are just.
Because I think that's all Jill and I would do. We would set up one trust for the two of us.
Correct.
And rights of successor, or however that works.
You would be co-trustees. It could be the Measle Family Trust.
Mm-hmm.
You would be co-trustees as long as both of you are alive. You just carry on like normal. And then when one of you would become incapacitated or pass away, the other would become the sole trustee.
Mm-hmm.
So, at the end of the packet, if you're interested, it just kind of puts in picture form kind of what happens without a trust and with a trust. So, without a trust, like all this stuff goes through probate. With a trust, it all goes through the trust and avoids probate. So, it's really too small to see up here, but if you've got a packet, it lists out which things pass through probate and not through probate. So, yes, the last chart.
I can reprint it larger if you want.
I can give you these to copy too.
Okay, because I printed it for. Did you get?
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so it's kind of small. She can't read it.
Got
so
it.
I can print this out full size if you want. If you want to be able to read her charts at the end.
The second one is without, or is with a trust. The first one is without a trust. Yes.
My husband and I had set up a ladybird deed trust, and now he's passed away. There's nothing I need to follow up on.
Yes.
There is?
Well, depending on what the ladybird deed says, do you have someone other than you listed?
Well, my husband and I have two children.
Are they the successors? Are they they're the beneficiaries?
Yes.
Okay, then if that's what you still want, then that is fine.
Okay.
It's essentially putting a beneficiary on your real estate.
Excellent.
Thanks.
Well, thank you, Tamara. And actually, that dovetailed very nicely with what Julie talked to us about from the foundation at the Church Extension Fund.
So you gave us some extra detail, which was wonderful. Tamara is not available for, you know, private consultation. She's got a full-time job. But she will answer questions. And if we see you, like, after church, you answer a question if we need?
Absolutely.
But do keep in mind, Julie from the CEF, she will, free of charge as a service of CEF, she'll come and talk to you about your individual circumstances and help you assemble those documents and get ready to go to an attorney. So I think what Julie talked about and what Tamara talked about, that merged very nicely. So I know some of you are nodding your head. Some of you may already have set up a trust or have a will, etc. Some of us, like me, have not. So I need to go through this process yet. So thank you, Tamara. That was excellent. All right. Well, she'll stick around for a few minutes if you have questions, I guess, and I'll be here too, but let's rise and close with the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. Thanks for coming. Have a good night. And Jeannie, I'll print out those last two slides full size. Anybody else want a copy of those?